Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about Auckland's change to COVID-19 alert level 2 vaccines, more funding to Rainbow Mental Health Services, and the former dual Australia-New Zealand citizen who was detained in Turkey for illegally entering from Syria. Here's the minister. Regarding the decision yesterday, why does Cabinet has decided to move alert levels to level 2 in Auckland while the source of the current infections haven't been discovered?
Look, finding out the source of every infection is, while that's desirable, it's not absolutely vital in order to move down alert levels. What we found is after 3 days, and even though we had two additional cases yesterday, all the cases known about, positive cases, were linked to each other. So although we haven't found the source, any other infections that have happened since the first case, case A and B, were discovered on the weekend, they've all been linked. So we, and bearing in mind that cases A and B had travelled pretty extensively, they've gone down to New Plymouth, travelled back, there's been no infection found as a result of their travelling to other parts. Those who have been infected have been confined to South Auckland, largely to Papatoetoe. And we were confident at that point that this round of infection is largely contained, and that justified moving down to alert level 2 for Auckland and alert level 1 for the rest of the country.
Okay, then moving on to vaccines. Now, case B in this case is working for in-flight services around Auckland Airport, and the case is involved in handling some of the laundry or even food brought in by international flights. So in this case, should we consider in-flight services workers or airport workers like baggage handlers and so on and so forth be considered as the same status as MIQ workers?
Well, there are some airport workers are. I mean, when we come to start administering the vaccine this weekend, the border workers will include those in airports. It'll be those who are facing passengers, so those who passengers see when they hop off airplanes and so on, as well as those at the managed isolation facilities. I expect that workers doing the work of the nature of case B, so doing auxiliary sort of work around airport and servicing aircraft, although not passenger facing, won't be far behind in the queue to get their vaccination. Now, there's a bit, I mean, we've had a lot of advice in the early days about, and they're certainly port workers, both airport workers and seaport workers, how far down the kind of the chain of contact you require them to undergo regular testing and all that sort of stuff. And we got to the point where someone in the position of a worker doing the laundry and stuff off airplanes would be on a 2-weekly testing cycle, whereas everybody else is on a 1-weekly testing cycle. But that means that that person on a 2-weekly testing cycle is still right up the front of the queue in terms of receiving the vaccination.
Still staying on vaccines, now the Ministry of Health, a recent survey found nearly a quarter of people it surveyed are unlikely to take a vaccine, and they found this Pacific and Māori communities are less receptive or less confident of a vaccine, as well as those having a lower household income and education. Now, as you say, the vaccination is starting this week. Is the government going to have a mass education drive on the vaccine?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of work going on at the moment, reaching into communities just to provide good information and good education. I think what the survey revealed was that there is a reasonably high degree of hesitancy about the vaccination, but not because people are necessarily anti-vaccinations per se. It's because they want to be sure that this particular vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine in relation to COVID-19, is effective, that it's not going to have dangerous side effects. And it's just about making sure there's good information to reassure people about what is happening and why it is happening. And what we're finding is that as people get good information and reliable information, actually their views do change and they feel more reassured about the safety of this particular vaccine.
Is there going to be a separate Māori are there specific campaigns for Māori and other ethnic communities to drive up the vaccination rates in their separate communities?
There won't be separate campaigns. Obviously, we know that Māori and Pasifika are more vulnerable if they get infected. So we want to make sure they get their vaccination, comparatively early. But we have a sequence by which we're rolling out the vaccine. Obviously, those working at the border are going to take priority, and those dealing with people who've just arrived from overseas, then health workers, then the families of those people all need to be vaccinated, and then we move into, and then elderly people, those in aged care and those looking after people in aged care facilities, and then there'll be a broader community campaign. We'll work with Hauora Māori kind of service providers to make sure we're getting into communities and Māori are getting their vaccinations, and likewise with Pasifika. So we have a sequence and we will follow through on that, and it is about making sure that those most susceptible to infection get dealt with first, and then those most susceptible, if they were infected to serious consequences, get vaccinated, and then everybody else follows from there.
Okay, moving on to another announcement that you made earlier this week. It's the $4 million funding for Rainbow Mental Health Services. So what is this about?
This is particular specific targeted funding to services and organisations that provide support to young people on mental health issues. So a lot of those organisations have had to stand in line and compete with others for that sort of funding. We made a decision a couple of years ago that there was a specific need to support those providing mental health support and services to young people. This does that. It's a start to making sure that there is discreet and clearly identified funding for young people. But there are other programs as well that we support. We're supporting Manaake and Piki program. Piki program is a pilot program around the Wellington area for young people, and we want to roll that out a little further eventually. But this is an indication and a follow-through on our commitment that we would have specific funding for youth mental health services.
Labour campaigned in 2020 on their rainbow policy is also included to, and I quote, ensure healthcare was responsive to the needs of trans, intersex and gender diverse people. So what does that exactly mean, and when can we see more about this?
We know that rainbow young people and transgender in particular are more susceptible to bullying and negative environments in their communities. And so this is about making sure that services and support are there, and particularly mental health services and support and counselling. And sometimes it's about helping families understand too what is happening. So this does that. So there are providers who are specifically targeted at young rainbow folks, and we want to make sure that they are properly funded and well supported to provide that support that is so necessary.
I know this isn't part of your portfolio anymore, but the Labour also promised to ban gay conversion therapy. I know the government said they will be doing this by the end of this year, but now there is a petition from the Green Party that had already got more than 140,000 signatures to ban it immediately. Can we see a time frame on that, banning gay conversion therapy?
Yeah, we are committed to getting that underway this year and hopefully concluded by the end of the year. It's not necessarily a straightforward issue, and so we do want to make sure that all elements of the human rights picture are taken account of. Obviously, anybody would say the idea that you would try to counsel a young person out of their sexuality is just ridiculous and can cause harm and does cause harm. So of course we want to stop that. The difficulty is how you define that. Somebody who happens to talk to, for example, a senior member of their church about their sexuality, and that church member says something that looks like or sounds like it's trying to tell them that they can do something about their sexuality. Is that going to be gay conversion therapy, or is it just somebody clumsily kind of responding to a query that they don't know properly how to respond to? Another year, I mean, I had an interesting conversation with a young transgender Indian Muslim on the weekend about this very issue, and she expressed some concern. She supported, obviously, the idea of banning gay conversion therapy, but the concern that she expressed was that her family is struggling with her identity. The imam of her mosque definitely does. And if it came to having to, you know, report somebody for gay conversion therapy, she wouldn't do so because these are the only communities she's got, and she doesn't want to, you know, be expelled from them, both her family and her mosque. So we just have to, you know, there are sensitivities to this, and it's not something that can be just sort of marched into willy-nilly. We've actually got to listen to voices, listen to others, and take care as we legislate for this.
Okay, moving to my final topic of this week is about the dual Australian and New Zealand woman that is now being detained in Turkey. Now, the Director General of the SIS, Rebecca Kittredge, said 5 years ago that less than a dozen of New Zealand women who travelled to Syria to join ISIS. Is Suhaira Aden, the woman in question, part of that list?
I'm not sure the Director General said that. I think what happened, she was asked a question about how many people, women, there might be with a New Zealand passport in conflict zones. She declines to give a number. And when a journalist put to her, is it less than a dozen? Rebecca Kittredge said yes. So, look, there are people over there with New Zealand citizenship. Suhaira Aden is one of them. We know that, and we also know that she previously had Australian citizenship. The reality is, from the age of six, she lived in Australia. That's where she's done her living. That's where most of her family are. And that's why our engagement with Australia and what happens to Suhaira Aden is, you know, is very important.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little. The Wire.